This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and I'm joined by my buddy from the Great White North. I'm going to awkwardly make you say, hey, it's Adam.
I thought you were just paused and lagging there.
Nope.
Hey, it's Adam.
Nice. Perfect. Great way to start the show. Let's see. Today, got another really great Cooking by Cuts episode for you. Excited for this one. We're going to be talking about the top round and the bottom round. So we've like, I would say we're probably 70% through the animal, if not a little more. And I'm pretty proud of our progress because we've stuck consistent to this. We've been doing this for now a few months, which is good. And then our next butchering episode, we're going to stay in the back quarter because it's where we're going to finish out and then do the offal after that. We'll talk about the tri-tip and the ive round, which are both really cool cuts, really tender cuts as we start to think about like the composition of cuts kind of in the back quarter. You get some like leaner, tougher cuts there as well that don't have as much fun flavor as the front shoulder tougher cuts do. So interesting comparison, and then we'll talk through all these in these two cuts today. But Adam's got some stuffs.
Yeah, I've actually since we're talking about upcoming podcasts, the next Antler and Fin coming out is going to be about goulash, which is I always considered a pretty interesting topic, and when I started digging into it, it's even more interesting. It's really cool dish that shaped a lot of Hungary's history, and then it somehow ended up in North America and became a completely different dish altogether. So I'm going to dig into that a little bit in the next Antler and Fin. So it seems like just a basic comfort dish, goulash, but there's a lot of cool history behind it. So stay tuned to that.
A lot of variations too, like regionally, and like what goes into your goulash.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pretty interesting dish.
Nice. Yeah, excited to hear that. So, you been up to anything else? Looking forward to anything?
Not much happening right now, but we've had one of the most mild winters I've ever experienced up here, and it seems like spring is here, and it might be a false one, but I think that there's a good chance that there's going to be spring mushrooms and shoots and stuff like that coming up pretty early this year, so I'm going to start, you know, poking around for those soon. Like pretty excited about that. And then I just on a message thread with a bunch of buddies about talking about turkey hunting. So we're starting to make plans for that too for the spring. So getting excited about those things. So looking forward to the spring.
Yeah, I too am excited about it. I mean, it's like right around the corner here in Colorado, just a little bit, about a month away, I think. And so that should be fun. Kicks off April 13th. So I think both Zoe and I will be going out to do some turkey hunting here because she's got her license now, so she can go out youth hunting. And then we were looking too, I think, like Kansas and Nebraska. When we drove through there, I picked up the brochures.
Oh, yeah.
And they have like $7 and $14 tags for youth. So like we may just drive up there, go stay a night and spend a day turkey hunting, and I'll call for her and let her maybe shoot some other turkey too over in the other states. Could be a cool little adventure for us.
Yeah, it'd be cool.
Yeah, well, let's get to the chopping block here and talk about some meats. So we'll start off with the top round. And in order of the way that I butcher, I probably wouldn't start with this one, but it's the top and the other one's the bottom. So we'll start at the top and work our way down. The top round, located on the back quarter, is a like wide, long, and kind of fat cut. So it's on the back leg of the animal, as I just said, what is also known as the hams. And it's kind of positioned on the inside. So if you think like the thigh portion, if you're trying to relate it, the inside thigh on a human person. And it's a pretty lean cut. You won't find much marbling there, and it can be a bit tough. And it's also a bit tough because it's got some other muscles running through it. And it's not super flavorful because it doesn't get like a ton of blood flow to that area. Like we talked about, like blood flow imparting flavor and, you know, getting used a lot imparting flavor. And so it's there. It's given the name top round because it's located directly above the bottom round and the eye of round in that round sort of primal. And you've got really the round primal and the sirloin primal, and then you've got your shank area of the back quarter, or the back leg, really. It's not the whole quarter. I'm trying to think, like, in my mind, and Adam, maybe you can help me ration this out, of like, it's called, you've got the one, I'm trying to think of the position of how it truly got the name top round over bottom round, because the way I butcher, I put the leg flat on the table and I see the bottom round first before I see the top round. Yeah. But I don't know if it's maybe the way it's hanging or if they butcher it the other way.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's a traditional butchery thing that it used to be done like that or lay down in a certain manner and that became the top. But it's called inside and outside round in a lot of other places too, which
yeah, makes that's it true.
A little more
that
sense.
Makes more sense. Yeah. Yeah. It makes more sense.
Top also has the gives it the like it's a higher quality. Like it's not, I don't think it's a great word for the cut.
Yeah, I agree because I don't think, you know, like we've talked about, there's not much difference in the two of them, mm-hmm. As far as like flavor or quality. I think so. It is the abductor femoris muscle. And a few others mixed in there, but that's the main one. And I think that femoris is because it connects directly to the femur bone, which we'll talk about in just a second. But it's kind of interesting that cut just in general and its positioning. So I mentioned how I typically position the cut and remove it. So I always start with the bottom round, removing that first. So let's just go back. Let me just back up a couple steps. So you've got the back quarter off the animal, which would be essentially the back leg. You've got it separated at the ball joint. It's laying ball joint side down on your table. and you're there looking at what is now a whole quarter in front of you. And the very first thing that I do is I locate the seam. There's two like parallel seams that run kind of the length of the main portion of that back leg. That in between those two seams in the center is where you would find your bottom round. So I always just find that because it's easy to locate. I know exactly where it's at. I know what it is. I go in those seams. I break those seams. I separate the seam where it connects kind of down. It doesn't connect all the way to the shank, but it almost does, almost to the heel and the top of kind of like the kneecap area. So you get that out of there, and then if it's connected anywhere to the top. So once you remove the bottom round, which I'll talk more about here in just a minute on it, particularly how to pull it out, you will see usually it's like a lot of tissue in there that looks like fat. Sometimes there will be fat, but there's a big gland in there. And that's that gland in the hind quarter that everybody always talks about. They're like, you got to remove that gland. Don't grind it. Don't do whatever. Like, get that out of there. You'll see it. It sets right literally in between the top round and the bottom round. And so you'll see it sit in there. Cut that out. And then you'll follow kind of the edge. So it would be, if you're looking at it, would be the, I don't know if it'd be the front of, it's the back. The eye of round is on the back of the leg. It's attached to the back of the top round. So I take the eye of round off and then start to really just follow the femur. You'll see it there right underneath where you remove that gland from, and you just follow it around until you hit the seam between the top round and the sirloin tip, and then you remove that, and your top round should just pop right off. So that's kind of the way that I think of it in my mind when I go to remove it. That's probably the easiest. Some people will take it off as a whole and then remove the eye round later. Or some people will start on the inside part of the leg and find that seam between the sirloin tip and the top round and start there and work their way around. But I like to get the bottom round out first just because it's pretty identifiable. But yeah, I think that's it. Do you have any other methods that you do, Adam? Anything different?
It's pretty similar. I don't know if I always start on the bottom round side or the top round. I'm trying to think of it. It's hard sometimes doing these podcasts without actually having the animal in front of you to butcher. But I think I've done both sides, but the starting at the bottom round, I think it's easier. One thing I find, like all these, like you're talking about seams, all these cuts are very recognizable and separated by really thin kind of membranes or seams. And
fascia.
It's you can just kind of see it, and you can almost separate half of these cuts with your fingers, not even mm-hmm. a knife, because you can just run your fingers kind of forcefully down one of the seams, and it will just like open separate the cuts, which I've always found interesting. The back leg. Once you can easily identify them through sight, you can just kind of open the whole thing up and dismantle it. And if anyone has gotten those nefarious leg steaks back from the butcher, that's just like a leg steak in quotes, and it's just a round steak with a bone in the middle. You can actually see the cross section of everything we're talking about. You'll be able to see, depending on where that was cut, you should be able to see the eye round, the inside round, the outside round, and the sirloin tip all just right there, because they basically just take a bandsaw and run the leg through the bandsaw, giving you kind of a cross section of that. So if you're interested to see kind of what we're talking about and you have one of those leg steaks in the freezer, take it out and you can probably see each one of those muscles.
I would say too, like if you want to do something good with a leg steak, you could probably go in there and break down those seams off of that, and you'll have like smaller medallions. But once you separate it from those seams, it'll actually cook better. Because I've noticed, and you know, we've talked about on here that if you've got the leg, the notorious leg steak, that there's still like that layer of silver skin all the way around the outside. And whenever it cooks, that silver skin shrinks and causes it to like buckle in the pan, so you don't get even cooking, really, and then you've got this weird-looking steak. But if you go in and you cut all those seams out and then cook the individual steaks, you're going to end up with, like, something a little better. So
yeah, I agree. They all have slightly different grains and cook slightly differently, enough so that you don't want to be cooking them all in one go.
Yeah, and they're not all ideal for steaks.
Not at all, no.
Like, I mean, you'll see this. We're going to talk about it here in just a minute. Like, not ideal for steaks. But let's see. So, what was the other thing I was going to say? Oh, that was it, too. Trimming silver skin. So, we'll talk about all these seam cuts kind of in general for the next couple weeks as we go through these, the back leg. But you want to make sure, unless you're going to braise them, that you get the silver skin off. I would say if you're going to freeze them whole or whatever, leave the silver skin on as an added layer of protection. But as soon as you're ready to cook, if you're not going to do like a low, slow braise, get that silver skin off, because it's going to inhibit that like true tender yumminess. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to braise it, leave it, because it's going to add extra flavor. Do you want to talk a little bit about the culinary history, Adam?
Yeah, sure. The this cut, it's known by a lot of different names. So you might find it as a silver side, which I think is maybe in Australia or UK. The top side, the inside round, and some people just call it the cube steak, because the cube steaks are really popular, I think, in the Midwest and down south. We don't really see them up here very much. But they're generally taken off the top and bottom rounds, so some people just call the whole cut a cube steak. Even when researching a little bit online here, I found when you're looking up like a top round, some people were just calling it a steak, even though it's a whole roast. It's very confusing. It's kind of a bit of a strange cut for that. So if you're looking online, you're trying to figure out what it is, it's most likely going to be called inside round or top round. It's a
inside round makes more sense to me, like just where it's positioned on the animal.
Yeah, I see that up here quite a bit, like in probably half the butcher shops is top and half it's inside. I don't know if that's sometimes we have a little bit of
mainly
American and British things combining,
mainly top round.
Yeah. It's a large, versatile cut. You can do a lot of different things with it, and so people around the world have done a lot of different things with it. It's not one of these little hidden steaks that we've been kind of talking about. It's kind of just a big hunk of meat, and it's made its way across the world. You can find it in a lot of like famous dishes, like Austrian Tafelspitz, which is usually made with a veal top round, and it's basically just boiled in broth and served with horseradish, a very plain kind of Austrian way. The infamous Chicago Italian beef sandwich is often made with it, and that's just like thin and slow cooked in its juices. Another famous dish, the British steak and Guinness pie, steak and kidney pie as well. They're generally using the top round for that, or silver side, as it's often called. South African biltong, which is their version of jerky, and absolutely delicious, is generally made with this cut as well. And then you often see it called sometimes London broil, which we mentioned for other cuts in the past. London broil is a strange term that gets tossed around a lot. Sometimes it refers to how it's cooked. Sometimes it refers to the cut itself. I would generally like to just strike it from the record altogether, because it's confusing and dumb. But you might see a dish called London broil made of this. And then the Swiss steak, too, which is kind of the same as cube steak. So these are some of the pretty like infamous dishes, and I could go on and on about all, like, around the world, how many people use this cut.
Wasn't it a cut off the front shoulder that was also called the London broil as well, I think?
I think so.
Like the arm, was it the arm?
Yeah, maybe the arm roast. Yeah, it's a confusing term. And then if you look into it, it shouldn't be used to signify the cut whatsoever. It's just the cooking method, which is like a broiled steak with Worcestershire sauce on it. But I don't know. It's something, as we've been doing this series, I keep encountering this stupid term, like, for almost every cut we're doing. And I'm kind of sick of it.
The infamous London broil. So, well, for cooking too, I'll talk a little bit about cooking since we're on that subject. So, it's one of those cuts too that can be like easily dried out, and that's just due to that overall lack of marbling. And that's similar too if you're looking for like beef as well. Just the presence of it there is not as lacking. So, if you are going to cook it whole as a roast, it's best to cook it rare, medium rare, or slow cook it in a liquid until it's like falling apart. That would cover like, geez, I think the Toffel Spitz, probably not saying it right, which boiled in broth, the Chicago Italian beef sandwich, the British steak pie, probably the London broil, and then the Swiss steak. It would be more of a cube, like you said. So, but I think some cool things to do with it. Obviously, with anything else, you can grind it. First off, out of the gate, you can grind it. But if you want to get more creative, you can stir fry it. So, thinly slice it, marinate it, and stir fry it briefly over high heat. You're still not looking for like super, super well done. You're okay doing like a mid-rare or rare even on your stir-fry meats, but because it's sliced so thin, you're just going to kind of get what you're going to get. But that marinade will help. And if you're slicing thin, like quarter inch, eighth of an inch, like pretty thin on the stir-fry. Cured. So Adam's got here like cured, smoke, and slice thin, as in pastrami. Cured, simmered, and sliced thick, like corned beef, or, you know, perfect if you're prepping for St. Paddy's Day, which by the time you listen to this, it will have already passed, so. And then cure, age, and slice super thin. So that's that bresciola, which is good too. So, and then jerky. So that's where you're going to slice it thin with the grain. You're going to marinate it, smoke it, or dehydrate it, or, well, you'll marinate it regardless. You could smoke or dehydrate it, or you could use your oven, which would dehydrate it also. And then as a steak, so you're going to cut it into a thin steak and pound it thinner, which would also tenderize it. You could also use the old jacquard, which is a fan favorite, or the meat mallet, which will also work. You can use it for things like schnitzel. You can then just do it into steaks, thick steaks, and sear on the grill to like a medium rare. Or you could cut into chunks for kebabs, things like that. I do want to say, we've talked about kebabs before. Adam's talked about kebabs. Don't stack all your veggies and meats on the same kebab because they cook at different temperatures.
It's a sin.
For doneness. It's a sin. Just do one skewer of meat, one skewer of tomatoes, one skewer of mushroom, like whatever. Whatever you want to do, do that. And then obviously you can do it as a whole cut, as a roast. So you could sear it and roast it until you get an internal temperature of like 125. Just remember, when you roast and cook things like that, you usually have a 5-degree jump on the end. So really you'd look to do it to 120 and expect it to jump about 5 degrees once it's out. You could sous vide it. Would be a great candidate for that. And then do like reverse sear on it at the end. You can braise it in liquid until it's falling apart. Kind of a shredded pulled pork type thing. Or you can roast it to rare, let it cool, and then slice for lunch meat. I would say to, oh no, we already talked about that, slice then like pastrami. Mm. So that would be like, even if you didn't cure it, you could still like smoke it or roast it like that and slice for lunch meat. And that would end up with like your lunch meat. Or you could cure it minus the pastrami seasonings and still slice it then for like some sort of like roasted.
And that's how I actually like I generally don't do rounds as a roast cut. I look elsewhere for that. But if I am going to be like getting my little meat slicer out and making like a stack kind of lunch meat sandwich or something, or rare venison kind of meat, then I'll probably look towards the bottom or top round to do that for sure. You just cook it super rare, let it cool completely, and then slice it, and it's really nice like that. Actually, it's got to be super thin though.
Super thin.
Yeah.
or it'll be not so tender.
Yeah.
No, that's a good summary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So let's see, moving on to the next. So we've got the bottom round. I like the bottom round because it's easily identifiable. They're all, once you learn them, they're all pretty easily identifiable. But on the actual animal itself, I always pick that one out first. So it is found underneath the top round, next to the eye of round, it's between the eye of round and the sirloin tip, as I mentioned earlier. So I would say underneath is proportionate to however you're doing it. The way I butcher, the bottom round is on top and the top round's on bottom. Flipped. Just flipped your universe. It is kind of a long rectangle piece of meat that's fairly uniform in its thickness. It does taper towards the bottom end a bit. It is slightly less tender than the top round, but you're going to experience the similar leanness. And I think it's less tender because it's outside of the muscle. It's getting hit and bumped and absorbs a lot. So, and then it's got a pretty consistent grain all the way through it, which is cool. So it makes it easy for knowing which direction to cut and expect what. So it is the biceps femoris muscle on the actual animal, and it's located kind of on picture. Well, you can't see in the video, or maybe you can. If this is the back leg, it's on the outside, so the outward facing part of the back leg. How to remove it? To me, very simple. I found those two parallel seams that run from the top of the back leg to the top of where your shank is, and you just literally make a little incision on each side. Like Adam mentioned, you can usually work your thumbs in there and kind of like peel away that fascia. And then you make a cut at the bottom where it connects to the shank, because that's where it kind of tapers off. And then you'll just kind of like peel it back. I usually peel it back from the direction of like at the sirloin back towards the eye of round. And then always find that gland after you've done it and get that gland out of there. So then once you do, there is like a good amount of silver skin on this cut, but also once you cut the silver skin off, it ends up being even more rectangular, which is good for some of the cooking applications. You want to talk a little bit about the culinary history?
Sure. So, this cut is often kind of mistakenly called the top round, or it's called just round altogether. I found that it's called, in some places, gooseneck. Sometimes they call the whole piece, like the eye round, the bottom round, and the sirloin tip, the gooseneck, when it's all still together. I'm trying to think if it looks like a gooseneck, but I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I was trying to think about that, too.
I don't know where they came up with that. This one can also be called the silver side.
I would argue that if you're going to call anything the gooseneck, you would call the eye of round a gooseneck, because it would be like
long and thin
like a gooseneck. But yeah, anyway, who knows? I'm not a historical butcher from the 1800s.
Who knows? You might also find this cut labeled as silver side as well. The outside round or the bottom round flat. So if you're out shopping for this or looking online, keep an eye out for those names. This is most commonly used as the cube steak. So when you get your cube steaks from the butcher, from the grocery store, it's probably being made with the bottom round. And it's often your classic pot roast cut. So kind of the old school Sunday roast, it's often the bottom round that's going to be relatively inexpensive. if it's braised in liquid, it can fall apart nicely.
Uniformly cooked.
Yeah. I always prefer shoulder for my pot roast kind of deal, but I think a lot of people like the bottom round because it doesn't have a lot of fat or connective tissue or anything. It's just basic meat. So if you're kind of turned off by other textures, like this is kind of a nice kind of plain roast that you can braise.
I mean, similar cooking style is the top round. So you could take it, you know, you could stir fry it, slice it very thin, stir fry it. You can certainly cure it, like we mentioned. Jerky, I've used it a lot for jerky as well, just because you get kind of these cool uniform pieces, which, you know, are nice. And then it's also a good candidate for a steak. Just know that you're going to get, like, smaller steaks out of it. I would say if you're going to cut it for steaks, something different to think about is if you got the piece laying flat out in front of you, instead of just, like, at a perfect downward cut, you know, is to come in a little bit of an angle, and then it's going to give you kind of a wider steak versus if you come down straight, you're just going to be limited to like that, you know, whatever it is, inch or two of actual steak.
Ooh, that's a good idea.
Would be a good way to do it. Plus, it's going to like kind of, it's going to reposition those grains a little differently. So that way, whenever you hit it with your old trusty Jacquard, that it will tenderize.
Right. For anyone then, who doesn't know what a Jacquard is, it's kind of like a, if you think of like a slap chop, if you remember that from the infomercials, it's basically has like a set of little needles and you just push it down into the meat and it kind of pierces the meat all at once, kind of with a large thing of needles, like a stamp or something, and apparently works really well for tenderizing. I've never actually used one myself.
I mean, I have one and I've used it. I don't know. Jury's out.
Yeah.
On it. You could also smack the crap out of it with a meat mallet.
That's the way I like to do it.
Yeah. Get out some frustrations at the same time. Although, I don't know. The Jacquard does feel a little like you can let loose.
Yeah.
You can just show that steak what's up. I don't know. You could also use a Jacquard on a roast or something too to like help some of the flavors like penetrate.
Yeah, I guess that would work. Yeah, might bring the marinade in or the brine.
Yeah, yeah, could be a little different technique. And then always you can roast this cut as well. Like Adam mentioned, the Sunday pot roast or a Saturday pot roast, depending on you know what you subscribe to.
I find with these cuts, like when I'm butchering, of all the cuts we've been through in the series so far, and kind of like, don't grind. I find I use these more for my grind. I use it for jerky. I use it for schnitzel, and I use it for stir fry. And I don't really use it for steaks or roast too often. I might a little, every once in a while. You get a fair amount of meat from both sides of one animal with these cuts, but I find they work really well for what I just mentioned, but otherwise I don't care for them quite as much as some of the other interesting cuts. So I find I dig into my grind pile, like dig into these cuts from my grind pile a little more, just to get grind.
I also too, like I find myself not grinding as much stuff.
Me too.
Just like kind of in my evolution as a butcher. I more lean towards like finding ways to cook whole cuts or like even breaking them down, but like grinding, like I don't find many ground meat recipes that really like get me going. Mm. Like I love a burger like the next guy. Like our goose burgers at Goose Camp were like phenomenal, and like I'll make meatballs or a burger, you know, maybe once or twice a month. But outside that, like, I'd rather just have, like, steak or whole cuts or, you know, like, shredded or braised meat or things like that versus just, I don't know. That's just me.
Yeah, I agree. I find burger, generally I go to it when I'm, like, getting home late and I'm really hungry and I don't feel like cooking, and I just make usually I make some sort of Asian noodle super dish with ground meat, and it's really quick and easy. And otherwise, I don't go for it that much, other than, you know, meatballs and burgers every once in a while. But I do go for stir fry. Like, I stir fry a lot for dinner, and I end up reaching for the round most often, like what that, I think.
And I think stir fry is great, right? It's quick, it's easy, yeah. It's just something you can, like, you get your hearty helping of meat and veggies,
yeah.
And then you serve it over rice or noodles, and it's like kind of a well-rounded meal. But I think, like, I don't know.
A well-rounded rounded meal?
Well-rounded meal.
Okay, we're done.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's talk a little bit about some recipes here. Adam, I'll let you go ahead and lead the way, and I'll get the next one.
Sure. So first up, chose a recipe from my website, theintrepideater.com. It's elk steak gochujang noodles. And I came up with this recipe when I was a little bit inebriated, coming home really late. And I wanted something really tasty, not just something crappy. And this recipe kind of came out of that. So you could use a lot of different meat for this, but I used elk round. You could use bottom or top round, doesn't really matter. Cut it into like 1 by 1 inch cubes. Season with salt. Boil some kind of Asian style noodles or Italian style noodles, long ones, doesn't matter, like spaghetti. Melt some butter and a little bit of oil in another skillet. Add the steak cubes, searing until browned. You don't want to cook them all the way through. They're nice if they're still, you know, medium rare, medium in the middle. Turn down the heat. Add some garlic gochujang, that Korean pepper paste that is so delicious. Gochugaru, which is Korean chili flakes. Soy sauce, honey, sesame oil, some green onions, and cilantro. Stir it all together. And then once the noodles are ready, you just throw those into the skillet with everything else with a cup of cooking water and finish them off with the sauce and boil it all down until the noodles are done. So you're kind of mixing Asian and Italian kind of noodle influences together. You end up with this like really rich, spicy, beautiful sauce and these chunks of meat, and super delicious. And it's pretty easy. And it takes the edge off a night out. I know from experience.
It sounds really tasty. Help rehydrate, reinvigorate before you go to bed. Yeah. You're hitting multiple like pleasure factors with that dish. I'm going to talk a little bit about the hot Italian venison sandwich. So this is a recipe over on Harvest of Nature by our very own Jeff Benda, also a big fan of the Jacquard. And this is a truly inspired recipe from the Windy City. And it uses a 3-pound roast, and you trim that silver skin off, as I mentioned. Then you're gonna go through there. So in a large cast iron skillet, you'll combine some beef broth, the salad dressing mix, which is good seasoned zesty Italian salad dressing mix. I would, if it was me and I was making this recipe, I would Google a homemade Italian dressing and I would use that instead of a package, but that's just me. But if you need it, you need it. Go with it. You're going to use 1/2 teaspoon each of garlic powder, onion powder, dried rosemary, dried oregano, and you're going to bring it to a simmer. And you add the hot liquid to a slow cooker and set it on low. You're going to heat 2 tablespoons of oil over medium-high heat, and you're going to sear each side of your roast about 5 minutes. Turn it as needed. You want that nice caramel Maillard reaction on that all as much as you can. Transfer the roast to your slow cooker with the liquid and cover it and cook on low for 8 hours or until the meat shreds easily with a fork. When you're ready to serve the sandwiches, you preheat your oven on the broil setting, slice Italian loaf or hoagie buns, depending on what part of the country you live in, 1/2 lengthways, and you're going to spoon some of the hot shredded meat mixture on it, on the bottom slice of the bread, and then you're going to add the roasted red peppers, pepperoncini, and cheese, what kind of cheese? Provolone or mozzarella. Then you're going to butter the top slice of bread, add more shredded cheese, and place both the top and bottom of the sandwich on a baking sheet and place in the oven on broil. For 2 minutes until you get your cheese nice and bubbly, serve it. Bada bing, bada boom, you got yourself a hot Italian venison sandwich. I would say alternatively, you could probably, as Adam mentioned, you could slice the meat thin and then braise it in a liquid. You may end up with it like actually cooking faster. You may not need the full 8 hours, but that's an alternative. But either way, really yummy sandwich. I'll tell you too, on the hoagie front, bought some hoagie rolls the other day because we were making hot dogs for a birthday party, and actually made a jerk lobster grilled cheese sandwiches with the hoagie buns, and I pressed them like a Cuban sandwich. Holy smokes. talk about late night inebriated food. I wasn't, but it would do the trick. So, all right, let's see. You want to do the next one there?
Sure. So this recipe is on the Harvesting Nature website. It is by our friend Arizada, and it's bourbon venison jerky. Like we mentioned a couple times, these cuts are really good for jerky. So if you guys are like jerky fans, I would be digging into the rounds to do most of my jerky. So what he does is basically takes the rounds and slices them into quarter or eighth of an inch slices. He recommends using a deli slicer if you have one, or a very sharp knife if you don't. And then you're making a marinade out of soy sauce, bourbon, Worcestershire, paprika, garlic powder, onion powder, coriander, cumin, and cayenne. And you're just going to let that sit. You're going to kind of massage it into the meat slices and let it sit overnight. Next day, you're going to pat everything dry with paper towel until there's no moisture left coming off. It's going to greatly reduce the cook or dehydration time, which is an important step. You're going to put the meat on a low smoker and cook it until the meat starts to crack when you bend it, which should be around 4 hours. Let the meat cool, and then you can store it in glass jars or Ziploc bags. But I've always found that storing jerky is a ridiculous notion because it's gone almost immediately whenever I make it or someone else I know makes it. So, yeah, that sounds like a great recipe. And we have a couple other jerky recipes on Harvest Nature 2 that are also good. So check that out if you're into making jerky.
And I'll talk quickly. So this recipe is mine. I called it the best wild pig cured ham. Of course, there's some debate around if it is the best. I think it's the best. Sorry, Adam Steele. Mine's better.
Shots fired.
I'm sure I'll hear about that later. Yeah. But so I will note with this one, I typically... you can use the top round or the sirloin for this recipe in particular. You can really, like, in a ham, you can use generally any of the cuts from the back quarter is pretty appropriate. But I shot or used this one. This one's a pork from our wild pig camp back, May 2022. It was a long time ago. Made this delicious ham. So I use an equilibrium brine, which is equilibrium cure, the way in which I prefer to cure, because it's all by weight, which is really important. So you'll see in this recipe, like, I get pretty granular on that. There are some cool conversions you can use. I actually have a link to the curing calculator that I use, that several of us use as well, to get the exact amount of what you want. So for this one in particular, like, it was 1,210 grams. Another important thing, I'll give a shout out to my neighbors to the north, is that using metric system when curing is much easier, because you can get much more exact. It was a 2.67 pound roast, and I used 5.29 grams of pink curing salt, 52.94 grams of sea salt, Also important, use sea salt versus iodized salt. 3/4 cup maple syrup, bay leaf, mustard seed, and garlic cloves. And that was my cure. I cured it. Let's see. I use the meat curing calculator to determine the ratios. Use the equilibrium wet brining method when you do it. So I had to increase the water percentage from 40% to 75% because of the amount of water I needed to completely cover the meat in my container. That's another very important thing. And then I used, my meat weight was 210 grams, and I came out with a 2.5% for salt and a 75% for water, which ended up giving me, you know, that 5.29 grams for pink curing salt. Here's the reason I use the grams versus ounces, because it gave me decimal 187 ounce. And if you've ever tried to weigh out decimal 187 ounce, good luck. And then sea salt, I went with 52.94, and then I needed about 1/4 gallon or 0.908 liters. So you measure the water first, put the meat in the container, add the plain water to cover, and then adjust the water percentage for the tool. I talk about why I use grams. Easy enough. Once you figure out your ratios, then I mix in the maple syrup, the bay leaf, the mustard seed, mix well. Then I add the meat into a non-reactive bowl, so that's either plastic or glass, and cover with the liquid. You could also vac seal it too if you've got one of those, like a chamber vac or a vac seal that doesn't suck up all the moisture or water into it. If you're putting it in a bowl, you may have to put something on top of it in order to like keep it submerged. I just used an empty mason jar. And then you're going to place the container in the refrigerator. The general rule for curing is 2 days per pound for small cuts and 3 days per pound for larger hams and shoulders. My pork was roughly like 2.7 pounds, so I rounded up and determined that it needed 6 days in the cure. And I double-checked my curing time using another calculator, which I link in the recipe. And that website that I use accounts for the thickness of the cut. So you get pretty exact. I got a little nerdy on this one, but it's okay. On the sixth day, I removed the pork from the refrigerator. I washed it with cold water just to get it clean, and I discarded the brine. I returned the meat to the container and covered it with clean cold water and let it set in the refrigerator for 24 hours. That'll help get some of the saltiness out. Brought my smoker after the 24-hour period. I got my smoker, hit it 325. I cooked it for about an hour and 35 minutes until the internal temp reached 145. Let's see. I also glazed it. So I made a glaze of butter, maple syrup, honey, Dijon mustard, and Harvesting Nature's ever-famous Big Game Blend. Mixed all that together and basically basted it. After the first hour, I glazed the meat every 15 minutes on both sides. So once the meat reached 145, I removed it from the smoker, let it rest for 15 minutes, and then sliced it and ate it very promptly. I did not have a problem storing it either, Adam. I ate it with like toast and pickles and mustard, and it was the best thing ever. So yeah, that's that. Let's see. What's up next?
So the next one up is a barbecue smoked venison recipe from John Vile. Field staff writer at Harvest Nature, a buddy of ours. So he takes 2-3 round roasts from the whitetail deer. So he takes a few of them, gets a couple cups of water simmering, adds some salt, some barbecue sauce, molasses, Harvest Nature Big Game Rub, and stir that until all the salt and the rubs kind of dissolve into the sauce or into the brine. You're basically making like brine with this. Remove it from the heat, allow it to cool, add some beer, and then add enough water at the end to make it a full gallon. Place in the fridge or on ice to cool completely before putting any meat into it. Then you add the round roast, the whole roast, to a Ziploc bag. Pour enough cold brine to thoroughly cover all the pieces. And then you're going to be putting those in a cooler or in the fridge for 2 to 3 days. You end up with some excess brine that you can use for chicken and pork, as he mentions in the recipe. Once the brining time is complete, remove the roast, place them on a sheet pan, pat them down with paper towels, and then sprinkle some more barbecue rub on top with a light drizzle of oil. Heat your smoker or grill to 225 degrees Fahrenheit. He recommends using fruit wood like cherry or apple, which goes quite nicely in the smoker. Add the roast and smoke for 2 to 4 hours, depending on the size, or until they hit an internal temperature of about 130 to 135 degrees. Going by temperature is a much better way to do that rather than by hours, because your smoker is probably not going to be the exact temperature it says, and your deer is not the same size as the next guy, so you're much better off going by temperature. Once you're done, you're going to allow the roast to rest for a while, but he recommends 20 to 30 minutes, and then thinly slice against the grain, pile the slices on a brioche bun with some fresh pickles, and drizzle it with your favorite barbecue sauce, and you got yourself a nice barbecue sandwich.
Oh, that sounds tasty. And then, too, I'll give an alternative here is the venison pastrami, which is also tasty. So I, too, have a venison Reuben recipe that uses, like, a corn venison that you could also use alternatively to this if you're not a pastrami fan. Also, the big difference between the two, John Vile, who wrote this recipe, uses a dry cure versus I used a wet cure for the corn venison. And let's see it. So he's going to use for his, so he's got 2 1-pound venison bottom round roast, and he uses, the dry cure, for the 2 pounds of venison is 2 tablespoons of Morton Tender Quick, 1 tablespoon of ground coriander, 1 tablespoon of dark brown sugar, and 1/2 tablespoon of fresh ground pepper. He does mention in here, too, and I'll talk about it in just a minute, that he's got some non-conventional ingredients for pastrami rub, but I think it's pretty cool. So you make sure it's amply coated on the 2 pieces of meat, place them in Ziploc bags, squeeze out all the air, and then put them in the roast in the refrigerator for 5 days, flipping them each day. That's important, so you get the liquid moving up and down through the roast, all that, as it kind of comes out. After 5 days, remove the roast, rinse them in cold water, remove any of the cure ingredients, place the roasts in a large bowl and fill with cool water. Let the roast desalinate on the counter for an hour while you prepare the pastrami rub. So, the pastrami rub is ground black pepper, ground coriander, dark brown sugar, ground mustard, garlic powder, onion powder, and ancho chili powder. I think traditionally you would not see brown sugar and ancho chili powder in a pastrami rub, but I think it's good.
I can see that working.
Yeah, totally. You'd remove the roast from the water, lightly blot them with a paper towel, and liberally apply the dry rub to all the surfaces of the roast and let the rub set up as you start the smoker. You set the smoke to 225. He used fruit wood, which I think is a great option, and you do 2 to 3 hours until the internal temperature hits 145. And then once they hit the target temperature, remove them and place the roast on a wire rack set on top of a sheet pan. Turn the smoker or oven to 275. Add 1 to 2 cups of water to the sheet pan and cover it in foil. Carefully place the pan in the oven or smoker and steam for 1 to 1.5 hours. Remove the foil and place the roast on a cutting board. Allow to rest for an hour. Slice against the grain and enjoy. And then, boom, you have pastrami, which sounds great. You could also do that, too. That would be a great recipe for, goose pastrami.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if we have a goose pastrami recipe on here or not, but you could sub that in for literally a bunch of different meats, for duck, for goose, for lots of other stuff too.
I think you could do heart, really, would probably really work pretty good.
Heart, ooh, yeah,
like venison moose heart or something.
Yeah. You want to hit the last one and close us out on the recipes?
Sure. So last recipe is a bison gyudon, which is can be found on the Intrepidator website as well. This is a super cool Japanese dish And it's really like a home style kind of dish. Like, it's not like the, you know, elegant sushi or the ramen that takes like 3 days to cook. This is like weeknight home kind of cooking. And it's basically, at its heart, it's just a steak rice bowl. Steak and onion rice bowl, I guess. So I made mine with bison. I used the top round for this one. You just heat some oil in a skillet, just over medium heat. Add 2 onions sliced thinly and cook for 3 minutes. And you're not really looking for these onions to brown. You just want to soften them. From there, you're going to add a dashi stock. And for those who don't know, dashi is a Japanese stock made from kombu seaweed and often a lot of other things. Katsuobushi is like a dried kind of fish flakes, a couple different things. But you can just use game stock if you want, or you can buy instant dashi granules. So it's kind of like a bouillon cube or something. You can just like add it to water and it makes dashi. You can find that at any Asian grocery store. It imparts a really distinct umami taste that's worth seeking out, I would say. So you're going to add your dashi, some sake, some soy, mirin, and sugar. All those can be found at any Asian store as well, and it's worth having in your pantry. So you just got this kind of onions in the liquid. Then you're going to add your thinly sliced bison meat. And you're going to do kind of as thinly as possible a slice on the bison. And then you're just going to cook until the liquid reduces into a thick sauce, which should take about, 6 to 10 minutes. And the onions are going to be nice and, like, absorb all that sauce. And the meat's going to be coated in it. It's going to be really nice. You're just going to serve that on top of rice with, like a poached or fried egg on top. Just garnish with some like chili flakes and sesame seeds and sliced green onions if you want. And it's just like a nice hearty bowl that comes together in like 20 minutes and is super delicious. And kind of has a different flavor profile than you might be used to, which is cool too. But it's nothing too exotic or scary. I'd say it's a... That should be in everyone's weeknight rotation.
Sounds pretty tasty. Yeah. I like it. Yeah, it sounds really yummy. Have you ever made the stock before?
Mm-hmm.
Like on your...
Yeah, I make it quite a bit.
On your own?
It's actually very easy to make. Yeah. You just need the ingredients.
Just typically go to like the Asian mart and pick up the ingredients.
Yeah, any Asian store should have it. It's kombu seaweed. You can make it with just kombu. You can look online. I have a recipe actually for dashi stock on my website. And you can do like a cold soak method where you just like brew it overnight in cold water. You can do a hot soak method, which happens faster. And then you can make a bunch and freeze it or keep it in big jars in the fridge and use it as you need. And yeah, it's great in soups or in stuff like this or cooking rice. It's where like they drew MSG from. Is from this kombu seaweed, so it just naturally has this like umami richness to it that's gonna impart, and everything is really good.
I think I've read like some of the articles on like how umami was discovered, and it talks about those ingredients like very clearly of like, and for those that don't know, umami being like you've got what, sour, sweet, salty, spicy,
bitter,
and then bitter, and then umami, and the guy who discovered it, also the same guy who created MSG, was sort of like discovered or created as a concept back, I think, like in the 1940s or 50s, like just before World War II. And then all the original texts were written in Japanese. So, well, as we went into the World War II, nobody cared anything about, at least from an American side, people didn't care much about what the Japanese were writing about because we were at war with them. And then even after, they're like, ugh, like grumbling. So you could see that it was overlooked for a very long time until like, I think the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, it started like coming on the rise of like, holy smokes, there's this whole other flavor concept that we've never explored.
And it's like the flavor of like mushrooms and tomatoes and steak and everything. It's like it's awesome. It's crazy. I didn't explore that
so
yet.
Good. Yeah. We're just like, we didn't have a word for it, which I think is cool. But so I think that wraps up both these cuts pretty well. I think it'll give you a good starting point for your own exploration and then as you're butchering and stuff. But Adam, any last thoughts or alibis before we sign off?
Yeah, I think when you're removing these cuts from a deer, animal, whatever animal you're doing, it's a lot of meat and you're going to want to be tempted to, you know, make into roast or steaks because it's just like whole big pieces of meat. And you have kind of four of them on the animal, so I recommend using some for something different. So try doing the stir fry meat, try some jerky, try the schnitzel, try breaking down into a couple different things and see how you like it. Since you have four massive pieces of meat, you have the space for experimentation, I think, and you'll probably be pretty happy with what you discover that way.
I think for me, as I think about it as well, we've got I'm gonna talk about labeling because you could make all sorts of things as you label. You can label for a purpose. You can label for whatever. But it's like literally like a whiteboard. You can put whatever you want on it. But I would label my loin steaks different than my top or bottom round steaks because they're going to perform very, very differently. And just understand, I think that's like a tip. That's a tip to, if I'm in the moment butchering, that's a tip to 8 months from now, Justin, who's digging through the freezer like, oh, steaks. And then I'm like, wait, which steaks are these? And so if you like labeled them ahead of time or whatever and make yourself little notes so you remember later. It's just a cool thought when it comes to like the tail end of the butchering process. But overall, two good steak or two good cuts of meat, very versatile. Experiment with them. I liked Adam's suggestion a lot of like use each one for something different. Or don't, whatever makes you happy, I guess, at the end of the day. But thanks everybody for listening. We'll make sure all the show notes are in here. We've got all the recipes listed, all that stuff. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, please punch that 5-star button. Leave us a review. Tell us we're doing right or, tell us we're doing wrong. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.